Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the LSE and welcome to the Literary Festival. It's the first full day of this week of the school's Space for Thought Literary Festival. My name is George Gaskell. I'm a professor here and I'm also chair of the Literary Festival Committee. Now, we've had a few events last week just to warm up, but tonight we are starting proper, and we have a week of really exciting explorations of revolutions, revolutions in art, science, international relations, politics, and much more. Now, little did we realize in, I think, April of last year, when we were thinking about this year's program, that revolutions would be a rather contemporary sort of topic. Revolution in truth, revolution in popular politics, and so forth. Now, alongside our discussions, we have various events taking place. We have a creative writing workshop. We have some events for children. And we have some exhibitions. Outside the theatre, you may have noticed some photographs and objects on display from LSE Ideas. One of our think tanks rated the either second or third best think tank on international relations in the world. And the exhibition is on revolutions in the Afghan desert, water, green technology, and illegal opium cultivation. So in a moment, I'll hand over to my colleague, Richard Bronk, who's going to introduce our speaker this evening. Richard is also a member of the Literary Festival Committee. Let me close by just welcoming you. Hope you come to some more of these events. We look forward to seeing you. And after this event, would you care to join us for a glass of wine somewhere outside the auditorium, where our speaker this evening, Tim Harford, will be signing copies of his book, Messi. And I've just discovered it's nothing to do with Barcelona's football team. Richard,
floor is
yours.
Thank you, George. My name is Richard Bronk, and I'm a visiting fellow at the European Institute here at the London School of Economics, and I'm chair of this event. In a moment, I'll be delighted to introduce Tim Harford, who will discuss his new book, Messi: How to Be Creative and Resilient in a Tidy-Minded World. But first, a little tidy housekeeping. Tim will speak for about 45 minutes, and after that, he has kindly agreed to answer questions from you, the audience. So if you have any questions, and I hope that you will, please save them up till then, and we'll have a roving microphone that will go around. This is important because the event is recorded, and we hope to make a podcast of it. The Twitter hashtag for the event is here, hashtag LSE LitFest. And at the end of the session, as George has said, while you're enjoying the drink he's just invited yourself, you to, Tim will be signing copies of his book outside. 200 years ago, the poet John Keats wrote that the basis of creative genius is the imaginative faculty he called negative capability, which he defined as being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without an irritable reaching after fact or reason. From reading Tim's book, I have an inkling that he's going to add a new angle to Keats's famous argument, that if you want to be creative, you should be willing to remain in a bit of a mess without a tidy-minded reaching after order and reason. But before I hand over to Tim, let me briefly introduce him to those few of you who are not already familiar with his columns and his newspaper and his radio shows. Tim is an economist, journalist, and author, and now has six books to his name, most famously The Undercover Economist, which, like the weekly column of the same name in the Financial Times, looks at the economic ideas behind everyday experiences. Tim was educated at Aylesbury Grammar School and then Brasenose College, Oxford, where he read Philosophy, Politics and Economics, or PPE, and then did an MPhil in economics. In addition to writing for the Financial Times and other newspapers around the world, Tim has for the last decade presented the BBC Radio 4's award-winning programme on statistics, More or Less. He's also More recently, he was telling me, started doing a radio program, 50 Things That Made the Modern Economy, 9-minute short takes on the world service and the internet, if you're interested. Tim's also won many awards, including the Society for Business Economists Writing Prize in 2014. So without further ado, please welcome Tim Harford.
Well, thank you so much, Richard. We'll get to Keats and creative ambiguity and such things. And I should say Messy is partly a book about why you shouldn't tell your children to tidy up their rooms, or alternatively why your parents shouldn't tell you to tidy up your room, and why your boss is an idiot for insisting on a clean desk policy, and why the magical self-organizing properties of big piles of paper. It is partly about that, but it is this partly also about a more metaphorical or more conceptual kind of mess. And I think to give you a sense of that more conceptual idea of mess, I want you to imagine an afternoon, really, it was 1975, early in 1975, in the Cologne Opera House. And the Cologne Opera House, I should say, is an enormous space. So I think that this is a beautiful big lecture hall we have here, and thank you all for coming. I think there are about 400 people here today, I'm told. Thank you. The Cologne Opera House holds 1,400. So if you imagine a room nearly four times the size of this one. And out onto the stage of that room strode a 17-year-old German girl, and her name was Vera Brandes. Now, Vera Brandes is an enthusiast, and specifically she's enthusiastic about jazz. She loves jazz. And the problem is there's not a lot of good jazz going on in Cologne. So Vera decides she has to do something about this, and so she becomes the youngest jazz concert promoter in the whole of Germany. She just starts organizing jazz concerts. And very early in her career, she scores a real coup. She persuades the Köln Opera House to host a late-night concert by the American pianist Keith Jarrett. Now, Jarrett is also quite young. He's about 30. He's played with the greats. He's played with Miles Davis. But he's not done solo concerts in front of anything like such a big audience as the Cologne Opera House. But it is a sellout. 1,400 people are going to be coming. And Keith Jarrett's going to be doing his thing. And what his thing is that he will sit down at the piano, no sheet music, no rehearsal, and he's just going to play. He is just going to improvise. That's what Keith Jarrett does. So Vera's thinking about all this. So she looks out at the empty Cologne Opera House. It's a few hours before the concert. The room is lit only by the dim green glow of the emergency exit signs. And the purpose of walking on the stage is to bring Keith Jarrett out and to introduce him to the piano. So out comes Keith Jarrett. He doesn't look happy. Immediately doesn't look happy. Plays a couple of notes. He goes over to his producer, Manfred Eicher, and mutter together. You can imagine how Vera's feeling right now. She's terrified. So Manfred Eicher walks over to the piano. He doesn't look happy. A few notes. He walks back. They're muttering. And then Manfred Eicher comes over to Vera and says, if you don't get a new piano, Keith won't play. So, I mean, Keith could be rather particular. But in this, I mean, he has been known to just yell at audience members for coughing during his concert. But, everybody? But this, not even ironic coughing, please. Now, on this particular occasion, he wasn't being fussy. There really was a problem with the piano. In fact, there were a lot of problems with the piano. There had been a mix-up. and the Cologne Opera House, who they're not that interested in jazz, you know, the clue's in the name, Opera House. Their crew has been told to find a Bösendorfer piano, and they found a Bösendorfer piano, but it's a rehearsal model. So the reason Jarrett immediately saw there was a problem is because the piano's too small. Like Vera later said, yeah, it was like a tiny piano, it was like half a piano. not big enough to fill it. Remember, it's a huge space. You need a proper concert grand. They don't have a concert grand. They've got this little rehearsal piano. And it gets worse. So as Jarrett plays the keys, he can see they're sticking. The pedals aren't working. The upper register of the piano is tinny because all the felt's worn away, so it doesn't sound good. Of course, it's out of tune. It's unplayable. And of course, Jarrett does not want to play it, so he leaves. And Vera Brandes, of course, gets on the phone and tries to arrange for a replacement piano, and she's even exploring, can her friends get together and wheel a grand piano through the rain from another venue? And she's told no, because grand pianos don't like being wheeled through the rain. It's not a good idea. It's Friday afternoon, it's Germany, everyone's gone home for the weekend. It's not happening. So she manages to find a piano tuner who can at least get the thing into tune, but most of the faults with this piano can't be fixed in time. So Vera then has only one option. She goes out of the opera house, she finds Keith Jarrett, who's sitting there in his car. She's standing there in the rain, she taps on the window, winds down the window, and she begs him. Begs him to play. And Jarrett looks out at this rain-drenched German teenager who was about to be ripped apart by 1,400 angry jazz fans. And he feels sorry for her. He looks to her, he says, never forget. Only for you. And so, a few hours later, in front of a packed auditorium, Keith Jarrett walks out onto the stage, he sits down at the unplayable piano, and he begins. And within moments, it becomes clear that something magical is happening. So Jarrett's avoiding these tinny upper notes, so he's sticking to the middle of the keys. And those middle range notes, they're very soothing. It's a wallpapery, ambient sort of quality. So that's nice, that's relaxing, and it's pleasant to listen to. And of course, it might get a little bit boring and a little bit new agey. But the other thing that Jarrett is trying to cope with is the fact that the piano is so quiet, people can't hear it. So he's rumbling up and down on the bass. He's creating these riffs. He's trying to create enough resonance to reach the people at the back of the auditorium. And the other thing he does is just to hit the piano so hard. He's standing up, and he's pounding down. He's got a bad back. He's twisting. He's moaning. You can hear him moaning on the recording of this performance. I don't know whether he's moaning in pleasure but it doesn't sound like it. And he's hitting this piano. And so that creates this amazing dynamism because the notes that he's playing are soothing and peaceful, but the way he's playing them has got this tremendous energy. And that tension, I think, creates this electrifying performance. And the audience loved it. An audience has continued to love it because Jarrett and Eicher recorded the concert. And it's called the Cologne Concert Album, and it's the best-selling jazz piano album in history. I love this album. I mean, two of my children were born while we were listening to Keith. My wife has mixed feelings about the album. And you may be thinking, why was it recorded? It was recorded because Keith Jarrett and his producer, Manfred Eicher, they wanted a documentary record of what a musical catastrophe sounds like. But they didn't get it, of course. They didn't get the musical catastrophe. They got this work of genius. Keith Jarrett was handed this mess, He embraced the mess, and he soared. And that's what I want to talk about this evening. Two things, really. First, why is it that when we're given these difficult situations, when we're given these obstacles, sometimes great things do happen as a result? And it is as a result. It was great because of the bad piano. It wasn't great despite the bad piano. It was great because of the bad piano. I also want to talk about that resistance that Keith Jarrett felt and the resistance that we all feel. Of course, when we're handed these hospital passes of situations, we don't think, well, Jarrett certainly didn't think, oh, wonderful, crap piano. This is an excellent opportunity to really sort of to get in touch with my creative side. He thought, crap piano is going to be a crap concert. Of course he did. Even an adventurous musician like Keith Jarrett, very brave, always searching for new ideas, even he didn't think it was going to be any good. And of course, any of us in any remotely similar situation, when we're faced with impossible deadlines or impossible colleagues or, you know, Windows has gone down again or whatever it is, you know, we don't think that those circumstances are going to lead us to produce our best work. And yet sometimes they do. So why is this? Why is this? Well, I want to give you a few different perspectives, because I don't think any single perspective on the phenomenon really quite explains it or is entirely persuasive by itself. But when you put them all together, you begin to understand what's happening. So these perspectives are from cognitive psychology, from complexity science, from social psychology, a little bit of economics, and of course, rock and roll, of course. So let's start with the cognitive psychology. So psychologists have known for a while that sometimes when you put obstacles in people's way, at least if they're modest obstacles, then people will overcompensate. So the general term for this idea is the theory of desirable difficulties. Now, my favourite example of desirable difficulties is a study that was conducted by a team of psychologists led by Richard Oppenheimer. And what they did was to team up with a group of high school teachers who were teaching various classes. And they said, we're going to run a randomised trial on your classes. We will reformat your handouts. So some of the classes are going to get your regular handouts, but they will be formatted in a fairly standard font, something like Helvetica or Arial. This is Arial, as you know, of course, because you're sophisticated people. You would never believe this to be Helvetica. Or maybe Times New Roman. Is it Arial? Has it been reformatted? And now, yeah, anyway, now I think, I doubt myself. I doubt myself now. It's definitely not Helvetica. Because, look, the terminals here would be... Anyway, we don't need to... In some ways, I'm a very tidy person. Now, half of these handouts are formatted in Times New Roman, Helvetica, Arial, standard sorts of fonts. The other half of the handouts... So classes are getting all of their handouts formatted in, say, Times New Roman. Other classes, chosen at random, are getting all of their handouts formatted in something different, like sort of the rather Germanic Hattenschweiler. Or, you know, monotype cursiva, which is designed to look like joined-up writing and is thus quite difficult to read. Or, of course, you could see this one coming, the zesty bounce of Comic Sans italicized. Now, okay, just have a look and just tell me which would you rather receive your course materials and handouts in? You know, Hattenschweiler? Arial? You would think... It's got to be easier to read in Arial or in Times New Roman. That's got to be easy. These are designed to be easy to read. Hattenschweiler, there's a certain kind of beauty, but it's not designed to be easy to read. And yet, people who were given their handouts in Hattenschweiler, monotype cursiva, or Comic Sans italicized, they did better. Outperformed their peers in end-of-semester exams. So what is going on? Because the font gods are not happy with this result. Well, we're not sure, but what we think is going on is that if you're given a page of text in Hattenschweiler, you go, what is this? So you pay attention. And then when you try and read it, it's not impossible. I mean, it's not Wingdings, right? It's not impossible, it's just a little bit more difficult. So when you read it, you slow down a little bit. So you're taking a bit more care. maybe if there's a word that's not so easy to read, you're interpolating, you're using your comprehension skills, you're just focused a bit more on the text. Because when you see it in Times New Roman, you feel like you've already read it. And so you never quite bother to engage. You skim over quickly. And you feel so fluent as you're reading, you don't actually take the time to understand what it is that you're reading. So, that's one perspective on what's going on. And I think one perspective on what happened to Keith Jarrett was that the difficulty of the situation, he wasn't given a banjo. He was still playing a piano, still his favourite instrument. I mean, to be honest, I think Keith Jarrett could probably do a mean banjo as well. He's an amazing man. But he's given his regular instrument, but it's just a bit more difficult. And he finds that there's some keys that don't work. He's good enough to avoid those keys. He's good enough to figure out that the top two octaves aren't sounding great and to go easy on them. He understands the volume. He can adjust and he can cope, but you can bet he's paying attention. He's really paying attention, and he's doing his absolute utmost to deliver a great performance. So maybe the unplayable piano is a little bit like Comic Sans italicized. So you might say to yourself, well, yeah, this is all very... all this stuff about creativity and sort of the genius of Keith Jarrett, it's all a little bit ineffable. I don't really believe that this applies to me. Well, let me give you a totally different perspective. And that perspective comes from complexity science, or really from just to trying to solve complex mathematical problems. So to give you an example of such a problem, the most famous example is the sexistly named travelling salesman problem, which I'd prefer to think of as the travelling salesperson problem. And the travelling, I mean, it's all completely archaic these days, I'm sure, but so the travelling salesperson problem involves a person driving from city to city, or maybe they're flying from city to city, and the problem is to minimise the distance driven, or possibly to minimise, if it's airfare, maybe you're trying to minimise the airfare, the total airfare. And you think, well, that doesn't sound too complicated a problem. You visit all the cities, minimise the total distance travelled. And it's not that difficult. If you've got 4, 5, 6 cities, it's pretty easy to find the optimal space. But the number of different possible combinations explodes. I was going to say it's exponential, but I think it's probably factorial. It goes absolutely... Once you've got 50 cities, 60 cities, 70 cities, it's inconceivable that you could check every different kind of combination. You couldn't possibly check every combination to solve this problem. Then you'd say, well, okay, but there must be a shortcut. There must be some way of figuring out what the solution is. You don't need to check every single combination. Well, it turns out, very important idea in mathematics, there is no shortcut. Yeah? I mean, when I say shortcut, I don't mean shortcut between the cities. I mean, there's no conceptual shortcut to finding the answer to this problem. So, okay, well, how do you solve it then? Well, you can't solve it. You can't solve it. Not enough time, not enough computing power. The best you can do is to find an acceptable solution, a pretty good route. How would you do that? Well, you get a computer on the case, and you give the computer a recipe. Oh, we don't call it recipe, we call it algorithm, but recipe, it means recipe. You give the computer these steps that the computer's going to follow in its search for an acceptable solution. So what kind of recipe might the computer follow? Well, excuse me, lots of different possibilities. One possibility is just random. Well, that's no better than just saying we're going to check every combination. What you're saying is we'll check every combination in a random order. That doesn't solve the problem. Another possibility is to say, let's search in a very systematic way. So we start from a random point, and then what we're going to do is we'll take any two cities and we'll swap them on the itinerary and ask if that's an improvement. If that's an improvement, then we keep that, and then we find another two cities and we'll swap them. You just keep swapping cities, and you keep looking for... step-by-step improvements. Every time you find a step-by-step improvement, you keep it, and every time you fail to find one, you try something else. Well, that's a pretty promising approach. And if your problem space is very narrow, like you work for, say, the British cycling team, then step-by-step marginal improvements, you get your long way. But it turns out in most fields of life, there are just too many different combinations, and the step-by-step approach doesn't work. And the reason the step-by-step approach doesn't work is because at some stage you get stuck. There's a point where if you rearranged a whole bunch of cities, you would find a shorter route. But there's no pair of cities that you could swap that would improve things. Now, you might be thinking, okay, but give me an actual example of this, not a travelling salesperson. Give me a real-world example of why this problem matters. Well, okay, let's say you're Intel, and you're trying to pack components on a computer chip. There are lots and lots of different ways to pack components on a computer chip. There are lots and lots of, I lose track of how many components are on a computer chip these days. I don't want to get all technical, but it's lots. Lots, lots, lots. And the number of different ways that you can pack lots of components is just impossibly huge. So again, you've got a similar kind of problem. You're programming a computer to design a computer chip, and the computer is searching for different ways to pack these components. And again, step by step, it gets you a certain part of the way there, but then you get stuck. You go down some dead end, and then there is no improvement from the dead end. The only way you can improve further is to back out of the dead end and go sideways and then try something totally different. Okay. What's this got to do with Keith Jarrett? Well, you can improve these algorithms, these recipes, by adding random shocks. Lots of different ways to do that, and it depends on the kind of problem you're trying to solve. But in general, add random shocks, especially near the beginning of this search. You've got your step-by-step process, random shocks, step-by-step process, random shocks, step-by-step process, maybe reduce the level of the random shocks, and eventually you get a solution. It won't be the very best solution, but it'll be a good solution. So you combine your search, your expert search, systematic search, with randomness, and you get a better result. And isn't that kind of what Keith Jarrett was doing? I mean, he's a brilliant pianist, and he's constantly searching for the very best approach to piano. He could have played the Köln concert performance on any piano, but it was only when he was given that sideways shock and given the bad piano that he actually found a way to play. Now, again, you may be saying, well, yes, well, that's all very well for Keith Jarrett, but Keith Jarrett's a genius at jazz, and I'm not a genius at jazz. So what's this got to do with me? Okay, fine. Who came here on the London Underground? Anyone? I don't know why I'm putting my hand up. I came here on a bike. But so some people came here on the Underground. Now, people who make the same trip every weekday morning and every weekday evening on the London Underground, there's a technical term for them. We call them commuters. Now, you would think, if anybody has really optimized their route anywhere, it is a London commuter. Yeah? You know where to stand on the platform, the Bakerloo line, so that you can, when you get off the train, then you could cross over to the Jubilee line at Baker Street, and that shortcut that there used to be on the Central Line around Tottenham Court Road, you know, against the one-way system, that one. And if you get off at Paddington, this particular place, you get the trains more easily. And you swore you'd never become that person when you moved to London, but you did, didn't you? Yeah, you did. How can you improve on perfection like that? Well, maybe adding a random shock might help. And it turns out there's some very kind ladies and gentlemen who work for the train drivers' unions who will, as a public service, occasionally administer a little shock to the system. So one strike that took place, I think, 3 years ago now, was studied by three economists. And the strike was a 48-hour strike, and it shut down two-thirds of the London Underground stations. But there were, various stations were still open, various lines were still open, and of course there's always the buses, and we love the buses. I used to live in Hackney, so they're the buses, they're the overground trains, the DLR. There are various parts of the system that still work. And you've got your Oyster card, and there you are as a commuter. Your regular route doesn't work. What are you going to do? Well, you've just been handed an unplayable piano. So the three economists who got hold of the data from the Oyster card system found that, obviously, lots and lots of regular commuters changed their route during the strike. Now, here's the thing. Tens of thousands of them never changed back. They discovered they'd been doing it wrong their entire lives. Can you imagine? You've been doing it for 40 years and there's a tube strike 2 months before you retire. You discover there was a better way all along. And of course, you know, all these people, they could have discovered them, this alternative route, just by exploring and searching. But we tend not to explore and search because we find a solution that seems like it's working and we just stick to that. And then we optimize in a very narrow range. Now, I'm not saying this happened to everybody. It only happened to about 5% of the people who switched. 5% is quite high. Think about commuters. The fact that 1 in 20 of them were able to find an improvement that they could then use for the rest of their the rest of the years they made that commute, they would be able to use that insight. It suggests that the occasional shock to the system is highly beneficial. So whether you are an algorithm trying to solve the travelling salesperson problem or you're just a commuter trying to get to work, try a little bit of a random shock. Now, I also promised a perspective from social psychology. Now, social psychology is it's kind of the study of how we deal with other people, which I personally find difficult because I'm an economist and, you know, I prefer numbers. but I try and keep up with the literature. So I've been reading social psychology. It's very interesting stuff. And social psychology is important for this whole area, this whole thing I'm talking about, because, of course, there is nothing more annoying and frustrating than other people. So the question then becomes, okay, it's not a tube strike, it's not a bad piano, it's not a difficult font, it's other people. How do we react when we're in the presence of people who, in some way or other, make us uncomfortable or challenge us, for whatever reason? There's a big, big literature, I think best summarised in Scott Page's book, The Difference. It's all about how more diverse teams are likely to be able to solve, not every problem, but they're able to solve a lot of problems better than homogenous teams. And the basic sort of intuition for this is pretty clear. Let's say you've got four economists in a room, and let's say they're all really good economists. They may all be really good, but they're all thinking about it as economists think. And they've got some problem, they're working on the problem, and then in comes a sociologist. And let's say the sociologist isn't as smart as the economist. It's hard to believe that might be true, but let's say it's true. The sociologist is still going to see things that the economists don't see. The sociologist has a perspective that you're not going to get just by adding a fifth economist. And the same thing is true if you've got five Londoners in a room and you add someone from Manchester, or from Paris, or from Singapore. Five women in a room and you add a man. Five young people in a room and you add someone who's retired. Just the moment you get someone in the room who has a different training, a different perspective, that is an opportunity for everybody to learn and to find different ways to approach problems. So Scott Page summarizes all this research, is terrific. And I talk about some of it in the book. But there's one particular example of this research which I found absolutely fascinating because it's a very, very cute little study done by three psychologists led by Catherine Phillips at Northwestern University. And what they did was they introduced some annoyance into a group of people in a very carefully controlled way. They grouped these people, they're all undergraduates, they're all in many ways thinking in similar ways. They grouped these people into groups of four, and they asked them to solve murder mystery problems. So you've got very tight control over the information you give people. You know, there's a dossier, there's been a murder, and here's the photos of the crime scene, here's the police statements, witness statements, alibis, all this stuff, and here are three suspects. Which of the three suspects did the crime? So you give a group of four people 20 minutes to solve this problem, and you see whether they succeed or not. So it's a very nice little study, and it's a randomized controlled trial. So in one half of the study, the group of four people working on the problem are all friends with each other. And in the other half of the study, the group of people working on the problem, three friends, one stranger. Now, for maximum awkwardness. But just to give you a sense of how difficult the problem is, so it's multiple choice, and if you work on this problem by yourself for 20 minutes, the chance you'll solve it is just under 50%. Which is not great, because chimps have a one-third success rate on this problem. If you give it to a group of four friends, the success rate rises from just under 50% to just over 50%. Not great. If you give it to the group of three friends and the stranger, the success rate goes up to 75%. So there's a huge jump in performance. And this is interesting because the stranger doesn't know anything else. It's not like the stranger is a forensic scientist. It's just the sheer awkwardness of having this stranger in the room with you. And, you know, you were talking to your friends and now there's this person. And so everyone has to just behave a bit differently and they have to kind of be on their best behavior and they have to be a bit more, fewer shortcuts, be a bit more specific about what they mean and why they mean it, and maybe be a little bit more respectful in their conversation. And just the dynamic is different, and the dynamic is different in a way that makes the problem much easier to solve. But here's why this study is really interesting. Catherine Phillips interviewed people about how they felt after this experience of solving the problem. And the groups of four friends, who, remember, were rubbish, they had A, had a great time, B, thought they'd nailed it. The groups of three friends and the stranger, who were excellent, A, felt pretty awkward, they didn't have a good time, and B, they thought they hadn't got the answer. They were much less confident. So the message here is it's not just that when you welcome somebody into a group who has a different way of thinking, who's unfamiliar, makes everyone feel a bit awkward, not only is that person likely to make you all smarter, that person is also likely to make you all feel uncomfortable and stupid. So we're systematically measuring the tidy group who are complacent and who are performing badly and who think they're performing well, and the messy group, the group with the frustration, the group with that sort of little extra bit of grit in the oyster, that group, they don't think they're doing well, they're not having a good time, but objectively speaking, we can measure their performance and it's much higher. So that's why I wanted the final perspective. I told you I'll give you cognitive psychology, I'll give you social psychology, I'll give you complexity science, I'll give you economics. Remember the three economists who did the tube strike? I'll give you all of that, but I wanted to end with rock and roll. And the reason I wanted to end with rock and roll is because there's one musician who I think has thought more about this, at least in music, than anybody else. And he's thought not only about the advantages of randomness, but he's also thought about the resistance to randomness. Now, his name's Brian Eno, and when I was working on the book, which will be available after the talk, by the way, Pages of Hackney, wonderful, wonderful local bookshop in Hackney, have come down here to sell copies of the book, so they should all, and copies of other authors' books, and they deserve your support. Even if you don't buy my book, go and buy somebody's book to support Pages and to support the Literary Festival. Anyway, but you could buy my book if you wanted. That's okay. So when I was working on the book, I thought the person I must interview about this, I must talk to Brian Eno, but he'll never talk to me. And then he said, no, I find this whole idea fascinating. I will talk to you. Now, half of you are currently going, Brian Eno, that's amazing. The other half are going, who's Brian Eno? Let me just explain. So Brian Eno, he started playing with Brian Ferry in Roxy Music, dressed as a wizard, long hair, playing the keyboard with a big plastic spoon and fork. He then went on to develop a totally new aesthetic called ambient music. He produced an album called Another Green World. Prince said it's the best album he's ever heard. He then had this career as sort of producer and provocateur. So he worked with the choreographer Twyla Tharp, worked with the minimalist composer Philip Glass, with Devo, with Gavin Bryars, with Coldplay, with U2, with a gentleman called David Bowie. You may have heard of him. And Eno worked with Bowie on three of Bowie's great albums, the Berlin trilogy, Low, Heroes, and Lodger. Although if I'm going to be pernickety, Low, Heroes, and Lodger, just get it right. The thing about the Heroes album, that's part of the, it's an ironic album. And I really had trouble with the proofreaders when I was writing the book. They kept taking that out. I was like, no. It's, yeah, anyway. where was I? Brian Eno. So Eno's worked with all these amazing musicians. And why do they value Eno? They value Eno because he is their unplayable piano. He is their ugly font. He's their Comic Sans italicized, right? He's the awkward stranger in the room. He gets them out of their comfort zone and he produces amazing results. And it's deliberate. It's not just his personality. This is a strategy. He's thought about this a lot. And one of the things he did, and still does, but one of the things he did when working on the Berlin trilogy was to show up in the recording studio with a deck of cards. They were called the Oblique Strategies. And the Oblique Strategies are just this simple white deck of cards with instructions on. The instructions might be something like, everyone change instruments. So brilliant. You've got the greatest guitarist on the planet in the studio and the greatest drummer on the planet. But unfortunately, the drummer is playing the guitar and the guitarist is playing the drums. That's the kind of thing. Or sometimes they're quite gnomic, like not building a wall, making a brick. Or sometimes they just say, go outside, shut the door. Or ask a question, is it finished? So just these provocations, these things to think about. And under the instruction of Eno and these cards, musicians would do all sorts of really annoying things that they hated. So Phil Collins played the drums on Another Green World, you know, the album that Prince loved. Phil Collins hated that experience so much, he was so frustrated. He ended up hurling beer cans across the studio. And it's just his rage and annoyance at the stupid things that Eno was getting him to do. Carlos Alomar, who played guitar on Heroes and on Lodger, amazing guitarist. Carlos, he would get so frustrated. He would say, Brian, this experiment is stupid. It sounds like crap. And yet, when you look back at these albums, they're masterpieces. And when you talk to the musicians about them, they will admit that in the end, although they didn't like it, it turned out it was helping. So Alomar said, those cards, they took me to another place. And to be honest, I did not like that place. But then when I came back, I was fresh. Maybe there was something to them. And Carlos Alomar teaches guitar in New York. And I recently heard that he is using the Oblique Strategies with his students. He says, I need them to feel the way I felt. That process of being shocked and searching and finding answers. But the other interesting thing about Eno, he's all over all of this. I mean, that early idea that the Hattenschweiler, that strange font makes you focus. He told me, focus is important. So the enemy of creative work is boredom. And the friend of creative work is attention. And you can see how that links into what I've been talking about, because when you are bored, you're not doing good work, but what bores you? What bores you is doing the same thing over and over again. You might say, why would I do the same thing over and over again? Well, we always do the same thing over and over again because that's how we end up commuting on the wrong route. You know, we form habits. We stick with our friends. We don't meet strangers. But the friend of creative work is attention. Well, when do you pay attention? Well, maybe when you're fascinated and delighted by something. But very often you pay attention because you feel threatened. You feel a bit scared. You're out of your comfort zone. You don't like what's going on. Then you're paying attention. So a lot of this involves some degree of discomfort. And that's why Eno decided that these things had to be cards. Because they weren't originally cards. Originally, they were a checklist. They were a list on the wall of the studio. So you get to the end of a long day and you just think, okay, in the press of things, I may have forgotten something. What's any ideas to try? Anything that might, you know, pep things up or be worth remembering or be worth experimenting with? And you look down the list. Then he said, it doesn't work. The list doesn't work. Why doesn't the list work? It doesn't work because you just go down and you find whatever is going to cause you the least inconvenience. Which is, of course, missing the point entirely. We are going to resist these frustrating situations. We are going to resist these obstacles. Resist working with strangers or with bad tools like Keith Jarrett's piano. Of course we will resist that. And that's why we need to push ourselves. And that's why we need to find ways to force ourselves sometimes. And maybe it's some weird experiment that means that you're reading in a strange font. Or maybe it's the turn of this random card. Or maybe it's a guilt trip from a German teenager. But whatever it is, all of us from time to time need to make ourselves sit down and play the unplayable piano. I'm happy to take questions, but thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, Tim. Now, we're going to do questions, and if you can please wait till the microphone gets to you, and we're going to take three questions at once, and then and Tim can decide which one is the one that really annoys him most and gets him gets his creative juices flowing. So please, can I take a question here, row three first?
See, Brian would say that you should take one question at random and you're forced to deal with it, but that's okay. I'm happy with the tidy questions.
Thanks, Tim. Your argument seems to work well for people, but how about for things like governments, say, trying to promote innovation? I remember an argument that, you know, systems get frozen and you need to shake them up. Governments seem ill-equipped to be messy.
Very good question. And on the edge of the row there with the hand up.
Let us consider the President of the United States an obstacle. What kind of shock is going to lead to some kind of success in dealing with him?
Okay, there's two such wonderful questions there. I'm going to stop and ask Tim those. So the government seemed to find it very hard to be messy, and is Trump the shock to the system par excellence?
Is Trump the unplayable piano? I'll be honest with you. I have thought about this question a bit already. And one might say the same thing about Brexit too. In fact, I wrote a piece for the Financial Times a couple of months ago asking if is Brexit the unplayable piano? And it was really an attempt to say, okay, Keith Jarrett had to do all these strange things and make all these accommodations and all these adjustments that you would have thought were not going to work out well. What are the weird things that we're going to have to do and the adjustments that we're going to have to make that seem like they're not going to work out well but might actually work out well? And I set those out for Brexit. I didn't totally convince myself. But obviously the 52% of the country can see what those things are. So we'll see. We'll see. I mean, Theresa May, after the Brexit vote, the first thing that she said when she was elected Prime Minister was she told her cabinet, I want you to all go away and find some opportunities, look for opportunities in this. And of course, you know, in some ways it's just cheap talk by politicians, but it's not a bad approach. Something's happened, you might not like it, but let's look for the opportunity. What is the opportunity in Trump? Well, I think we first need to acknowledge sometimes a disaster is a disaster, okay? So, just because there can be, amazing things can come out of disruptions doesn't mean amazing things come out of all disruptions. So I want to acknowledge that straight away, and I know many people around the world are worried about what comes next. But what positive things might come? Well, just to list a few, there is the idea that Gridlock in US government might be broken. There are various investments in infrastructure, just narrow economic thing. There are various investments in infrastructure that have just been blocked and blocked and blocked. And suddenly the combination of a populist who wants to spend money and has obviously got a lot of people behind him, and Congress who have the power and feel they need to back him, maybe that'll be good. That's certainly what the stock market seems to think. What else? Subscriptions, I believe, to the New York Times and to the Washington Post are up. And I don't think that in itself... I mean, some of my best friends write for the New York Times and the Washington Post, and obviously I wish them all well, but in and of itself that's not important, but if that indicates that people have suddenly realised that politics matters and that facts are worth taking seriously and are worth defending and are worth paying money for, that's an example of a positive thing. So, it's anybody's guess what will happen. My instinct is a lot of harm has already been done and a lot of harm will be done in the future. But we, while guarding against that, we need to also look out for the good sides and look out for the opportunities, and I think they are there. On the subject of governments in general not being good at mess... You're certainly right. Governments in general try to minimise the extent to which they are disrupted. Change is generally bad because any change you can name will disadvantage somebody, and the person who's disadvantaged is always going to make a big noise, and the person who's advantaged will often not even notice. So in general, things get calcified and ossified. And when governments do shake things up, they often don't gather the data necessary to figure out whether that's an improvement or not, because they think they feel that the data might be challenging. So this is something that I emphasise more in a previous book, Adapt, which maybe is also on sale, I don't know, which is all about experimentation, the use of trial and error, and the importance of trial and error. And one of the points that I've come to realise is governments can run experiments, but they generally can't do so effectively at the top level, because the political pressures on politicians are, we blame ourselves, we voters, we punish politicians for U-turns, we punish politicians for producing evidence that they've made mistakes. So what needs to be done is the experiments need to be pushed down to a more technocratic level. So a politician can talk about all the amazing and cool things they're going to do in education, and then turn around, which actually the coalition government did, then turn around and say we're going to fund large numbers of experiments in schools run by technocrats, run by teachers and academics to try and figure out how to improve schools. And we'll gather lots of data, and some of the stuff will work and some of the stuff will not work, but all of it will be underneath the Westminster radar. So maybe the messiness has to be applied under the surface.
Right, some more questions. The lady in the middle row up here.
Just to say, I would be sad if nobody asks me about how piles of paper self-organise. It's really interesting. Richard, you'll ask me about piles of paper if nobody does, won't you?
I thought your point about diversity of teams was really interesting, and they're more productive. And I wondered if your research found a kind of tipping point. So five economists and a sociologist produce better results, but how about five economists, a sociologist, a historian, vet, and somebody else? Is there a point where diversity kind of undermines productivity?
Insert punchline here, yeah. Thank you.
Any more questions? No? Okay.
There's several questions at the front.
Sorry, one here.
Thank you very much. The experiment at Northwestern that produced such an interesting result, where the people who were doing very well didn't realize they were doing very well, I suppose they eventually found out afterwards, the professor told them, you did well. But in a situation outside a controlled experiment, in an office, a group of colleagues, where you might not look as if you're doing well or think you're doing well for a long time, and there's no measurable evidence that you're doing well for a while, how does it play out outside the controlled experiment?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And in the second row here.
Thank you. What does the advantage of the disruptive stranger tell you about advantages of coalition governments?
Okay. Thank you very much. So all three questions really about diversity. I don't have any brilliant insights on coalition government. I know there have been some interesting probably books written, and certainly sort of think pieces and reports. And my understanding from a distance was that coalition government worked quite well in that it forced an open discussion of the issues and an active role for expert advice and expert mediation. So my understanding is that while not everyone would have been happy with every decision taken by David Cameron's government, there were definitely positive sides for coalition. But you know, I haven't made a careful study of this at all, and I'm sure there are counterexamples. So diversity in smaller teams, how does it work outside the lab? Well, I think maybe I should have been more explicit about this, but I think the problem is that we, given that we don't get feedback outside the lab, and we just sort of ask ourselves, well, how are things going? And if we feel uncomfortable, we mistake that feeling for poor performance. We tend to avoid people who make us feel uncomfortable. We tend to avoid people who disagree with us. We tend to avoid people from different disciplines with different outlooks. This is a very well-documented trend in human behavior. There's a wonderful study I describe in the book, which I can just tell you the title. It's Do People Mix at Mixers? The answer is no. They basically give people these little tags so they could track where they were during this kind of business school mixer at Columbia Business School. And everyone showed up for a networking event, and everybody told the researchers, we're here to meet new people, and we're here to broaden our social networks. We're not here to drink with our mates. And that they then proceeded to drink with their mates. So we need to push ourselves, because I think I'm not saying that more diversity is always better. I'm not saying that more generally that more randomness, more difficult fonts, more unplayable pianos. I'm not saying that's always better. I am saying that our sort of internal thermostat will tend to be too tidy. Not enough disruption. Not enough change. Not enough strangers. Not enough difficulties. And we will find if we add a bit of randomness, we add a bit of new experiences, difficulties, obstacles, that will tend to help us. Which comes to your question about the tipping point. I don't know what the tipping point is. I'm sure in certain circumstances, so someone like Scott Page could study it algorithmically. So he would build models of this and different kinds of formal problems and show how much diversity helps and how much doesn't. Generally, the question is going to be, how quickly do you need to coordinate? How important is rapid communication and really understanding where other people are coming from? If you're a SWAT team, it probably doesn't help if you all speak different languages and have never trained together. So it's going to depend on the kind of problem. But again, as this gentleman's question, the tipping point is probably more diverse than we think. There are, of course, costs to this. So one wonderful study that was actually described, I heard about it at the LSE Talks podcast. I advise that you subscribe to the podcast. It's wonderful. If you're listening to this on the LSE Talks podcast, don't bother. You're already subscribed. So the research was done by David Stark and Matthijs de Van and Balázs Vedres, three mathematically minded sociologists, and they studied every computer game that had ever been made, and they had a network diagram of all the people who'd worked on all of these computer games, assembled from sort of lists of such things out. And what you're able to do is, unlike a lot of network studies where the network is like, here's the network, now let's study how information or something moves across the network, you're able to study how the network forms, comes together, splits apart as different teams of people work on different games. And they said, what is the pathway that leads to the best games? What kind of teams work on the best games? And what they found was it was a particular kind of pattern. So it was homogeneous teams who'd worked again and again and again on the same kind of project and thus really understood each other, in coalition with several other teams who would work again and again with each other on very different kinds of problems, and then you bring these different teams together, and you've got a Hollywood blockbuster about, you know, superheroes not working together or something. You get this tremendous friction and tribalism. It's very difficult because people really understand their club and they don't understand these other people who are approaching a problem completely differently. And these people have worked on role-playing games, and those people have worked on shoot-em-ups, and those people only do film noir, and it's very frustrating, and you get great games. But what Balázs Vedrés told me is you can track how long these teams last, and they don't last that long. And you get a lot of pressure on the people who are on the boundary points, who are trying to tie these teams together, who maybe worked with both teams in the past, trying to keep it together. It's a difficult, difficult job. So don't expect it to last. There are costs, but you get great games.
Some more questions. And the fourth row here.
Hi, I'd like to ask a question. My husband is a primary school teacher, and I work in the health service. And those two systems, everything about them says order, particularly education, I think, for young people these days. So I'd really love to ask you what your wish list would be for education to inject disorder into it.
Mm-hmm. And in the sixth row here, next to the person in the university T-shirt. There.
Thank you for a very interesting talk. You made a very powerful case, and I'm convinced, but I'm kind of wondering what prescriptions can emerge out of this. So it seems like these kind of recommendations of injecting shock have to be scaffolded to the individuals, kind of the zone of proximal development that they go through. So how can we actually come up with, I mean, I recognize the irony of finding this neat solution to you know, a messy recommendation, but how can we actually kind of inject this? It's kind of similar to in the education system or in other organizations, you know, when you have challenges like diverse, like too much diversity or communication problems.
So my question has to do with the idea that you need to inject discomfort to come up with better results. And I was just thinking about the idea, maybe more from a psychological point of view, how that discomfort doesn't necessarily have to come from an external source, it could be also self-inflicted. But yeah, because we're assuming that you don't know yourself well enough to know where those boundaries are for your self-comfort. But I think maybe a good balance between self-inflicted discomfort and then knowing how to maybe react positively to those external discomforts would be, and maybe actually I'm replying a little bit to the lady there, but that would be a good approach to incorporating that messiness.
Sure. Thank you for all the questions. How to inject disorder into primary schools? Well, there are the kids. They help. I have a 5-year-old son and a 10-year-old daughter, and there's plenty of disorder. But I think I understand the point. And so a couple of thoughts. One is that we need to stop treating all variation as threatening. So one of the phrases that I really dislike is the postcode lottery. You can get some certain kind of treatment if you live here and some certain kind of treatment, or the schools in such and such a place will offer these subjects, and if you go to some other place, they offer different subjects. That could signify injustice, but it could just also be that, you know, different places make different choices. It's not a lottery, for a start, because you don't get assigned a postcode at random. But also, the fact that it's different is an opportunity to learn. And so if different areas are trying different things, if different schools are trying different things, if different hospitals are trying different things, that is an opportunity to learn what's working and what's not working. But we need the right structures available to let us learn from that variation. And very often what we have instead is a system of targets which is trying to squeeze out all possible variation. There is a chapter in the book on targets. And I don't want to sort of summarize it too tightly, but basically my idea is targets led to the VW emissions scandal, the banking crisis, the collapse of the ambulance service, etc., etc. Basically, they don't work, and they don't work for quite predictable reasons, because they are always tidy-minded, and the world is messy. And the moment you try and impose the target, you get all kinds of gaming and distortions and all sorts of very, very unwelcome behaviours. And in an unpredictable system, you have to allow the individuals who are empowered to see what's going on, that is, the doctors, the nurses, the teachers, and so on. You have to give them more trust and more freedom to do what they think is right, because the targets will never account for everything. There's also a wonderful book on experiments in education, co-authored by David Torgerson and Ben Goldacre, which I think you can download, and it's great. And it's just a case of empowering. Doctors run their own experiments. Teachers get experimented on badly. So Ben's idea is maybe teachers can somehow rise up and run their own experiments and learn about what's working, what's not in the classroom. Prescriptions for Life. Is there an app for messiness? So it turns out there is. You can download the Oblique Strategies app on your phone. And, I mean, I don't want to make this all about Oblique Strategies, but there is a certain kind of magic in them. So one experience I had of this was a few months ago I went to the studios of Planet Money in New York. Planet Money, if you don't subscribe to the Planet Money podcast, you're making a terrible, terrible life-changing mistake. And you must all go and subscribe to Planet Money because it's wonderful. And I said, I've got this book, but it's kind of about creativity. It's not really about economics. And they said, it's okay, Tim, you know, friend of the program, come on and we'll find something for you to do. So I went into the studios of Planet Money and they turned on the mics and they switched on the recording things. And they said, here's the thing, Tim. The Nobel Prize was awarded this week. It's kind of boring and technical. We have to do the Nobel Prize every year and we're a bit bored of it and we don't know what to do. But you're a creative guru now, Tim. So solve the problem for us. And I thought, you bastards. But I had Oblique Strategies on my phone. And I said, okay, and I told them about Brian Eno and David Bowie. And of course I'm thinking, oh, it sounds great when you tell them David Bowie did it. It's not so easy when you're trying to figure out how to report the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics, which is technical. And we drew an Oblique Strategy. And it was, if I remember rightly, what frame would look right. So there's this pause, and then we started talking about, well, what does that actually... That's a challenge. Brian's given us a challenge. And maybe it's all about, well, we shouldn't talk about this year's Nobel Prize in Economics. We should talk about, why is there a Nobel Prize in Economics? And of course, yes, it's not actually a Nobel Prize, which is one of the reasons why it's interesting. What's the context? What's the backstory? And that turned into a really fascinating item. And they said, okay, let's do another one. So we did another one, we drew another one, and it was not building a wall, making a brick. And then there was this, everyone was like, whoa. And then we started talking and we agreed, now what we're going to do is we're going to zoom in on one tiny detail of this year's Nobel Prize. And they said, what's the tiny detail? I said, Oliver Hart changed his mind. So Oliver Hart was one of the winners of the Nobel Prize. He's changed his mind about one of the most important things he won the Nobel Prize for. Let's just talk about that. You don't have to talk about everything, just talk about that. And it went on. And it was amazing to feel the energy level rise in the room. And to my embarrassment, I've sort of written all about the Oblique Strategies, but I don't use them very much because they're threatening. They are threatening. So, yeah, so my prescription is, why not try something like that? Try the Oblique Strategies, download the app, Or maybe if you're facing a problem or just an empty weekend, write down 6 options, all of which are a little bit outside your comfort zone, all of which are interesting. Roll the dice. See what happens. Internally imposed discomfort. So there's one of the things I talk about in the book is multitasking. And it turns out multitasking gets an unfairly bad press. I am not in favor of multitasking, reading your email while you're trying to have a conversation, sexting in lectures. It's not good. Watching TV while driving, none of it's good. But there is another kind of multitasking. Maybe we need a different word for it, which is you're working on a project and you work on it for whatever, 20 minutes, 20 days, and you stop and you say, no, I'm going to work on a different project. And you switch and you go to a different kind of project and you work on a different project. Then you switch back to the first project. And then after a while, you go back to the second project. Then you go to a third project. Then you go back to the first project and the second project and the first project and the third project. And you switch between these projects. Turns out this is the creative pattern of almost everybody interesting you've ever heard of. So a number of psychologists have looked into this using various different methods, history of science, interviews with highly creative people in the arts, in the sciences, novelists, going through diaries of people who are long dead, and you get this project switching. And I think the project switching is an attempt to deal with what happens when you've been stuck. So you've taken your step-by-step-by-step improvements, and you get stuck. What do? You switch to something totally new. And that's the source of new creative ideas. And organizations do sometimes do this. So 3M is the most famous. They will just rotate people. Okay, I know you've worked all your career on cathode ray tubes, but now you're going to work in the sellotape department. Because we just think that they'll learn from you and you'll learn from them, and away you go. And so that rotation between projects turns out to be an important source of kind of, not necessarily discomfort, but an important source of something new. One other thing, there's a really cool new book by Stephen Johnson. Came out in the States a few months ago, came out in the UK, I think just last week, called Wonderland. And it's about the importance of play. And I feel that Wonderland is like the flip side of messy. What I'm saying is attention is incredibly important, and one of the things that gets your attention is uncomfortable situations, new people, new places, difficult tools. And Stephen's saying, you know what else gets your attention is when you are absolutely delighted with something. Spices, beautiful clothes, computer games, anything. Just playing with toys and games and equipment. And the intersection between the two books is Brian Eno. So if you don't fancy buying Messi, you might fancy buying Stephen's book, Wonderland. It's very, very good.
Now, you wanted to ask yourself a question about self-organising.
Is that too tidy-minded?
Yeah, a bit tidy. So just make it a little bit less tidy. In the science of complexity theory, as I understand it, one of the ideas is that you only get dynamic self-organising systems at that kind of sweet spot between chaos and static order. So it comes back a bit to the earlier question about can you have too much chaos or mess. So I'll just part that with you, and then a couple more questions. At the very back.
Hi, thank you for your presentation. My question is about failure and the consequences of failure. Because actually you made me think so much of Kate Johnston's and Impro and like taking the fear of failure out of the picture. And actually, giving random shocks, people who give random shocks are rewarded with discovery and adventure. People who don't want to do that are rewarded with safety in some way. Now, I'm fine trying different commute, I'm fine trying different things at the restaurant, because the failure there, the consequences of failure are relatively low. But I'm not fine with a surgeon telling me that the surgery didn't go well because he was giving a random shock to his routine somewhere. So, or in the case of politics and Trump and military, and so, but each, I mean, some fields are like, objectively speaking, the consequences of failure could be very big, and so we seek safety. But this is also very personal, no? Some of us, I mean, you didn't want to come here 1 hour late and tell us, guys, I was giving my commuter a random shock, and I mean, this is the consequence of it, no?
Yep.
So what's the limit? And also, if there are some fields which are more important, where we seek safety and we cannot give random shocks there, are we rewarded with discovery just in trivial fields?
Yeah. It's a race between the two microphones.
Hi. Thank you for the talk. And would you say that falling in love is a random shock? And if so, how can you bring this to your life if you want a random shock? Okay, this really sounded bad, but
So, thank you all, all for your questions. Can you have too much chaos? Yes, absolutely, of course you can have too much chaos. But the argument of the book is not a little bit more chaos is always better. The argument of the book is most people are probably on the too much order side of things. And so if you try a little bit more chaos, see what happens, you might find you're surprised. On the paper. So look, okay. You've got a pile of paper on your desk. This is magic, right? So you take a piece of paper out because you're working on it, and you read the paper or whatever, and then you put it back on the top of the pile of paper, and you take another piece of paper out, and you work on it, and you put it on top of the pile of paper, and you take a piece of paper out, and so on. What's happening to the pile of paper? It appears to be randomly organized, but it's not randomly organized. It is organized according to a rule that computer scientists call the least recently used principle. So least recently used at the bottom, most recently used at the top. So the stuff you've touched recently rises to the top. The stuff you're not touching sinks to the bottom. What else is organized this way? Turns out that a computer memory cache is organized this way. Because a memory cache is basically fast... I mean, they're actually, in modern computers, there are caches in caches in caches, but basically the idea of a memory cache is it's rapid memory you can access quickly, but it's not very big. So the question is, what do you put in the memory cache that you can get at quickly versus all the other memory that it takes ages to get hold of? A good answer to that question, it will make your computers run much, much faster. Well, it turns out... that you can prove that for most problems, the least recently used rule is very, very effective. So computer memory caches usually work by just throwing out whatever has been least recently used and by keeping whatever you've touched recently, because whatever you've touched recently is probably something you're going to touch again soon. So your boss or your mum or whatever may argue that it's just a pile of paper on a desk, but you know that it is a... least recently used organized memory cache. And it is stacked for instant access to the most relevant materials. And by the way, so that's the computer science perspective, but there's a psychologist called Steve Whitaker who studies this stuff. And Steve Whitaker, he's got a good book out. It's called The Science of Managing Our Digital Stuff. It's quite academic, but it's good. And he studies how we organize email and PowerPoint presentations and everything. And his observation, proper academic study, is people with piles of paper around their desks are often very effective. And the reason they're often very effective is because those piles of paper are self-organizing. And then what you do is you pick up the pile of paper, you realize all the stuff in the bottom is rubbish, you throw it away. You then file the stuff in the top, which you understand. So your archives are very well organized, and you know exactly what's in them, and you use the stuff in them. Whereas people who instead clear their desk, they clear everything into the archive immediately. They don't really understand it. They've got duplicate files everywhere. Their archives are absolutely rammed full, and they get nothing done. But their desk looks really tidy. So, falling in love. It turns out there's a chapter on this in the book. And what I'm particularly interested in is our strangely persistent belief that if only we give enough information to a computer, the computer will find the perfect person for us. And this, this belief existed before computers. There were kind of previous machines that would, there was the Schmira graph and so on, that was the 1920s. You know, you smelled your potential partner's armpits and something to do with, well, we scientifically match horses, so why not people? Anyway, then when computers came along and started to become accessible to hackers in the 60s, so a group of students at Harvard, I think, not MIT, I think it was Harvard, launched Operation Match. And Operation Match was this dating operation where they said, right, send us $3, which is quite a lot of money in the 60s, and send us your details, fill in all this information, we'll feed it into an IBM supercomputer. This is about as powerful as my watch. Which does nothing except tell the time. We'll feed it into the supercomputer at 3 o'clock on a Sunday morning, which is when we can get access to the mainframe, and we'll spit out the answers and we'll give you the perfect match. And what they were actually doing, they later admitted, they weren't matching for compatibility. They said they were matching for compatibility, and people believed the computer would match for compatibility. But in fact, what they were doing was matching for zip code. So this person's single. Female, heterosexual, you're male, heterosexual, you live near each other, boom. And then you'd have these great dates because people would then meet and they'd be going, wow, what is it about you that makes you, the computer, think you're you? A fantastic date, so very, very successful. Anyway, it turns out OkCupid accidentally reran this. So they, OkCupid, much more modern website. If you've ever been on OkCupid, hundreds and hundreds of questions, you fill in all these questions and it gives you the perfect match, except it's the, I mean, they're still, they are running an algorithm to try to match people. But what they did was they said, let's run an experiment where we take people who are not matched at all, but we tell them they're matched. Turns out, it's just as good. It's just as good. So, you know, by all means, you know, find love however you like, whether it's, you know, going to bars or an arranged marriage or whether you feed a bunch of data into a computer. But let's not make the mistake of thinking that actually this very tidy algorithm is actually going to help. Improvisation.
Where is failure too dangerous?
Yes. Well, but actually, this gentleman particularly mentioned Keith Johnston's Impro, which is a very, very important book about improvising and acting, and it's a wonderful book. And there are two chapters in the book in Messy on improvisation. So when is improvisation too dangerous? Well, one of the best improvisers of modern times is Donald Trump, it turns out. He's very, I mean, I wouldn't pay to watch a Donald Trump show, but he, in many ways, his campaign improvised its way to victory in the presidential election. He was just faster and more agile. You could particularly see it in the Republican primary. He just kept changing the news cycle faster than Jeb Bush's focus groups could respond to. And another brilliant improviser who I discussed in the book, Erwin Rommel, unfortunately Hitler's favourite general, spent a lot of time kicking the British army up and down North Africa. An amazing improviser. You couldn't think of much higher stakes than the Second World War. But you know, he improvised, and it was a very, very successful competitive strategy. It's obviously better if you can improvise where there's some kind of safety net. That's great. And one of the interesting changes we see recently is Hollywood movies are much more improvised. Hollywood comedies are much more improvised. Why are they improvised? They're improvised because the editing technology's got better, and you've got digital filming. So you could just... Previously, you had to improvise with a pen and paper in the writer's room. You'd write the script, and then the improvisation would basically stop, and you'd go and film the movie. Because you couldn't afford to do multiple takes, you had to get it right. When the cost of failure went down, people just started improvising much more. We get funnier movies based on lots and lots of improvisation. It's just some poor guy's job to go through hundreds and hundreds of hours of, you know, sometimes funny and sometimes not funny improvisation to figure out how to make a movie out of it, and it works very well. We can't eliminate risk, and I think we have to recognise that sometimes we over-perceive risk. We see risks that are not really there. And Johnston's right. Johnston encourages improvisers to recognize that actually if you say something slightly embarrassing on a stage, as I'm sure I've done in the last 90 minutes, that's not necessarily the end of the world, and it might be the way that you tap into something really exciting. So one of the case studies in the book is the rhetorical style of Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King, when he was a young man, meticulously rehearsed everything. He would write his sermons out. He'd spend a good 15 hours perfecting each 20-minute Sunday sermon. References, reading list, everything. Write it all out, memorize it word for word, leave his notes on his seat, walk up to the pulpit and deliver these fantastic speeches. And people, he was famous as a really great speaker. Then he got drawn into the civil rights movement, somewhat reluctantly. A young kid, Yoki, his daughter, was just a couple of weeks old. She wasn't sleeping well, so he wasn't sleeping well. He was exhausted. And Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycott. And suddenly he is bounced into running the Montgomery bus boycott. And he doesn't feel equipped. He doesn't feel ready. And suddenly he has to go to Holt Street Church in Montgomery and give a speech to the largest audience he's ever faced, and all the newspapers, and the TV cameras. And he hasn't got 15 hours, he hasn't got 15 minutes to prepare this speech. He describes in his autobiography, going to his study, he hasn't had lunch, he skips supper, he hasn't got time, and he thinks, what am I going to say? He prays. He's a minister, after all. He just thinks of a couple of points, a couple of notes, and then he drives to the Holt Street Church. And he has to stop on the way to the Holt Street Church because the crowd is so big. So the stakes are unbelievably high. And then he walks up to the pulpit and he begins to talk. And there are errors and there are mistakes, and the last line of that speech is really weak. It is the most remarkable speech he's ever given. And people who saw him that day, who've seen him every week in church, said, I had no idea that Martin Luther King could speak with so much force. And he did it because he had to, but he didn't want to. But like Keith Johnson, Keith Jarrett, he didn't have any choice. He just had to do it. And that's when he discovered that improvisation can be more powerful. So yes, it's imperfect. Yes, it's messy. Yes, there are things that if he'd written it down as a script, he would have changed. But when we expose ourselves to these challenging situations, sometimes we're able to tap into magic. That's what Keith Jarrett did. That's what Martin Luther King did. And thank goodness he took that risk.
Before we bring this event to a close, I just want to remind you, in case you've missed it, that Tim's book is on sale out there, and he will be signing copies. And as George said, you're cordially invited to the reception afterwards, and please do join us for other events during the Literary Festival, which runs until Saturday this week. But please join me now in showing your appreciation for Tim's fascinating...